Ronald Reagan became the governor of California after the 1966 election, the state was facing a budget crisis, one that he had promised to fix, while at the same time reducing taxes. At the time, California also had a system of higher education that was the envy of the rest of the world. Well, I think you can see where this is going. Reagan assured people that he didn't intend to harm the university, while at the same time saying that taxpayers could no longer afford to pay for things like intellectual curiosity. The speech that Reagan gave in February 1967 is the point that my guest this hour says was the day the purpose of higher education changed. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Dan Barrett is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, covering teaching, curriculum, and research on higher ed. His article, The Day the Purpose of College Changed, appears in the January 26th edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Mr. Barrett, thanks for joining me on the Kathleen Dunn Show today.
Thanks very much, John. Happy to be here.
So give us some context for Reagan's remarks in February of 67 about higher education. I mean, the whole speech wasn't just about higher education. California had some pretty big budget fish to fry. Higher ed was only a piece of that. But what was the situation in California when Reagan came into office?
It was, in the context here, was a press conference in Sacramento. I believe it was his eighth press conference of the year. And it was a pretty wide-ranging press conference. It talked about the highway department. I believe the budget was about $300 million in the red. Not sure what percentage of the overall budget that was, but, you know, significant enough that there needed to be some belt tightening. I mean, the other important piece of context here is that Reagan had come to power largely by using higher education as a foil. This is after the campus protests in the 60s, where he really took the protesters to task as filthy speech advocates, which is his term. So he was used to casting higher education as something of an opponent.
Yeah, that's his conflicts with students were pretty well documented, both before and after he became the governor of California. So Reagan talked about what he called intellectual luxuries, the idea that taxpayers shouldn't have to subsidize intellectual curiosity. Was there an audience he was playing to with this? Was this some sort of code for something else? What was he really talking about here?
That's a great question. We don't really know. I mean, Reagan was actually fairly conflicted himself on these things. As I pointed in the article, he himself is a product of a liberal education. He went to Eureka College and spoke throughout his life quite glowingly of the education and the experience that he had there. You know, he may have been talking about education as what he called, you know, diploma mill factory education. He used that phrase more than once to talk about the University of California system. You know, he could have been talking to sort of what has been described as kind of the lower or white middle class or white blue collar working class voter that he was appealing to, people who maybe hadn't gone to college and were repulsed by what they were seeing going on there. I mean, it's interesting, the two examples he gives as intellectual curiosity or intellectual luxuries, one is this a four-credit course at UC Davis on peaceful protests, which is actually something of the LA Times kind of fact-checked that and said, you know, it was actually more of an independent study, you know, and maybe at a time when there is lots of violent protest, this is a course in nonviolent protest, maybe it wasn't such a luxury after all. The other example he gave would probably strike many listeners' ears today as fairly practical. It was a course in the repair of band instruments, actually a master's degree in that at an unnamed Midwestern university. So who knows? I mean, maybe in some sort of Cody's talking about the arts on some level, and certainly about politics in the first example.
Well, I mean, it's not unusual for people who attack higher education to pick things like this. Was he trying to indicate that this was all that the universities were doing? Were they getting any credit at all for other courses that they were teaching, including business and economics and all sorts of other things the universities were doing?
Well, he would give them some credit, and that certainly was what the LA Times was pointing out too. That they had quite a robust response about a week and a half later. But it's important to bear in mind that Reagan also cut the allocation for the university system about 20% a year. So, if there was austerity there, it was at his own hand here.
Mm-hmm. 800-486-8655 is the number to call. We have already had quite a bit of Facebook activity. There's quite a lively discussion going on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and it's kind of going two ways, but I want to set this up a little bit more first, because one of the things you kind of juxtapose in your article this seeming conflict between the idea of a liberal education and intellectual curiosity and knowledge, gaining knowledge as a value in and of itself, which is one way to look at education, and a more career-oriented purpose for higher education, which has been promoted. Ronald Reagan promoted it. Others have promoted it if all these college graduates, what kind of jobs are out there for philosophy majors? Again, kind of an extreme example. I don't think there are that many philosophy majors, but, what kind of jobs can somebody with this or that major get? We need people who are good in technology, and we need people to fill the jobs pipeline and that kind of thing. And so there's this conflict between those two things. Where did we get the idea of a liberal education and the value of intellectual curiosity, what's the source for that? Where does that come from? What tradition forms the background for that?
Well, it goes back centuries, and I trace it back at least to Thomas Jefferson, who talks about it as it's sort of a classical education, and it's these terms have morphed and changed over time. And I do want to get back to this sort of seeming contradiction you talk about. Jefferson talks, he uses the actual phrase liberal education as being something that anyone of, I think he says, native genius, regardless of what their class is or their station in life, they ought to have access to that. And, you could argue that liberal education always has some sort of practical purpose that it serves, and in Jefferson's time, the practical purpose was serving the new republic that was growing. And now, liberal education, and this gets to your previous point, is sometimes in service of getting a job. If it's not vocational, it is practical. It's applied, and I think even defenders of liberal education would say, even a philosophy major, and perhaps even especially a philosophy major, can do well in the workforce. The problem becomes when you only emphasize the latter, meaning the kind of practical applied, and forget about the former. And I guess what I argue is I see much more discussion in the public sphere about colleges needing to be job creation tools, and less about developing abilities that might not have an immediately apparent payoff.
Well, we certainly could list a number of CEOs for major corporations who didn't go to business school. I mean, or their undergraduate degree, even if they got an MBA later, their undergraduate degree might have been in history or sociology or something like that, something in the liberal arts. And we also hear calls from businesses saying, listen, you know, we can train people on that whatever technology we have here or the processes we use at this corporation, but we need people who know how to think, who have critical thinking skills, who know how to make decisions, who know how to process things logically, and like that. And I guess, to me, it almost seems like a false dichotomy to say that this is an either-or proposition, that we can either have people who are intellectually curious or we can have people who are prepared to go to work. Is it fair to say that that's a false dichotomy?
I think when you look at it deeply enough, it does become a false dichotomy. I think the purpose in this article was pointing out the fact that I think we've forgotten about that first part, and we talk almost exclusively of college as a means to get a job. And obviously these two things feed each other. I mean, if anybody who works at a job is sooner or later, or anyone who lives a life is sooner or later going to confront a problem that does not have a simple, easy, and fixed solution. And the argument of liberal education advocates is that by learning in this way, with this approach, you are better able to deal with unfamiliar problems.
Well, this seems like it might be a better both and rather than either or argument. But if I'm looking at the Facebook comment, and one person points out that the first federal financial aid for college was national defense loans under Eisenhower. The idea there was to get more people educated so that they could get jobs in engineering and science and keep pace with the communists. And then we wanted to send people to college. We had the GI Bill after World War II. The idea was to get more people educated. They'd be better off economically if they knew more. And that's certainly not the only time that we've seen that kind of interest. Right now, there's a great deal of emphasis in the so-called STEM fields. And some have said that this is an overemphasis. It just seems like we seem to always be fighting the last war, to put it in military terms. We're always looking behind us to see what we should do next, and maybe that's not the right way to look at this.
That's possible. I mean, the point about the National Defense Act is very much, I think, of a piece with what I was saying before, that in Jefferson's time, the pressing need for education was to build an informed electorate. And during the National Defense Act, it was to build up a populace that could catch up to the Soviets, you know, who had just launched Sputnik, you know. I think there's a way in which higher education is kind of a vessel for our larger aspirations and anxieties as a society.
And we're going to take a break here in just a moment, but I want when we come back, I'd like you to maybe address this issue. Perhaps one of the reasons this is really kind of coming to the fore as a debate right now is the actual cost to the individual of a college education and the enormous amount of debt that students emerge from an undergraduate program with these days. It looks like two or three times at a minimum what I paid for the first house I ever bought. And you could buy a couple of really nice cars with what these students are coming out of college in terms of their debt load. And so maybe we're seeing more emphasis on, hey, these people have to be able to get good jobs because look at all this money they have to be able to pay off. I want to just have you address maybe what that aspect of this is doing to the debate itself, how that may be twisting it a little bit. We're talking about the purpose of higher education today. The genesis of this discussion is an article in the January 26th, 2015 edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education by Dan Barrett, who's my guest, titled The Day the Purpose of College Changed. Talks about a speech that Ronald Reagan gave in 1967 and basically said, hey, we can't afford the luxury of intellectual curiosity. Taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing that. And we're talking about how that has changed the discussion, not just in California, but across the country. We're certainly seeing it here in the state of Wisconsin, and where the governor has recently announced as part of his next budget that the UW system is going to receive a $300 million cut, about 13% of its state budget. of its budget that will be gone. And what's that mean? And what is the purpose of the university in these times? Wondering what you think at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have callers online. We'll get to those calls in just a moment. And also a very lively discussion on Facebook, on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can add your voice to that discussion as well. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the purpose of higher education with Dan Barrett with the Chronicle of Higher Education, whose article titled "The Day the Purpose of College Changed" appears in the January 26th edition of the Chronicle. 800-486-8655 is the number to call. We'll get to calls in just a moment. But first, Dan Barrett, my question before the break, the discussion these days driven by not only the economy, but the amount of debt load that students exit college with, more and more focus on how much money am I going to make when I graduate, less and less interest in how curious can I be during my 4, 5, or maybe even 6 years of college education. How do you think that actually affects the discussion?
Oh, I think it affects it profoundly, and I think the this goes back to federal and state policy. There's been a documented drop in state higher ed appropriations, as you are experiencing there with Governor Walker's proposed cut of $300 million for the UW system. And really, the rhetoric that Reagan deployed in 1967. Previewed some larger structural changes, and one of those structural changes was the fact that that I think higher education started to be seen more as a private good instead of a public one. And what that means in policy terms is that it's not something that the public pays for as much as it's something that the individual pays for. And as a result, you know, if you're coming out of college with a lot more debt, sure, you're going to be a lot more interested in a job. And colleges are trying to be responsive to their students. You know, they call them customers sometimes, to the great dismay of some who work in the academic world. But, yeah, it's absolutely, I think, a key driver in this whole conversation.
Quite a contrast between today and, say, the presidential commission that Harry Truman chartered in 1947 that you cite in your article. Quite a difference between what we think of this today and what we thought in 1947.
No, absolutely. I mean, the Truman Commission is, I think, a multi-volume thing. I mean, it's when you think now where, you know, a 50 to 100 page white paper is all you're going to get on a subject like this, and they're dedicating reams and reams of pages and really talking about college in a very broad sense. You know, it's something that ought to foster democracy and, in a sense, kind of be resistant to forces of conformity. You know, they talk about kind of the need to develop kind of intellectual independence through education. It really is quite a contrast.
Well, we have full phones. We need to take some calls. Let's start in Delavan, where Marty is on the phone with us. Marty, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. This conservative ideology, of which Lord Ronald Reagan seems to be the poster child for, of cutting taxes and cutting spending at the same time, correct me if I'm wrong, seems to always lead to a deficit. You could look at Kansas, you look at Wisconsin, and education is always one of the areas where they cut money from. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot. How does this party subsist? How do they exist doing this? My jaw is just agape at how this party keeps, you know, there hasn't been a Republican president to balance a budget for at least 70 years. You have to go back to Roosevelt. What is their allure?
Marty, thanks for the call. That kind of goes back to your comment about this education being seen as something that individuals should pay for.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it's pretty ideologically consistent for Reagan. You know, he just you know, his personal experience at Eureka College, he went in the throes of the Depression, and he wrote almost lovingly of the fact that his faculty members there, you know, went without paychecks for weeks at a time because they were so dedicated to what they were doing. You know, this is education as a kind of a private good and a private virtue, as opposed to something that we all ought to pay for. You know, and to be fair, some of the people I spoke to were almost most critical of President Obama. His push for free community college and kind of greater degree attainment is quite often couched in the sense of go to college and get a certificate for a particular job. And some are very critical of what they see as his kind of vocational push here.
Mm-hmm. 800-486-8655. Marty, thanks for the call. Let's go to Lucia in Milwaukee. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I was a philosophy major a long time ago. I graduated in 1962. And at that point, it was an appealing and interesting major, but I've gone on to be to work for nonprofit institutions as a development director, and I think it had a benefit to society from that standpoint. Our children were all liberal arts majors, and have gone on to do things they didn't even know existed when they were in college. So I think you can't say that there's a direct correlation between what you study in college and the work you're going to do or the benefits you're going to have to society. The other correlation is clearly if you look at the cost of state support for prisons and you look at state support for universities, it seems to me that we've sort of made the wrong decision there as a society.
Lucia, thanks so much for that call. We really have kind of flipped things upside down. We spend more on prisons than we do on universities these days.
That is a trend that that does seem to be out there. I mean, I think one thing that we ought to bear in mind here with higher education is that from the state lawmakers' perspective, it's one of the few areas of the government that can generate its own revenue. And so that can't be forgotten here. You know, I mean, a college can charge tuition in ways that other branches of the government are really kind of just cost centers. So I think that's a big part of the story here, too.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Aaron in Milwaukee. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I was just calling to say that I feel like we don't put enough emphasis on other educational aspects like trade and, you know, agriculture, et cetera. When we put too much emphasis on getting a bachelor's degree, I feel like every kid is going to get a bachelor's degree now in areas that may not be of high need. You know, with all respect, you know, philosophy degrees and others, those are very, very important, and they prove to society, in my opinion, how great and how far we've come. But if there's no hiring for that area, why are we putting such an emphasis on it, and why are we so surprised when people don't get jobs in that area? I really respect those people. I just am curious of what the speaker has to say on that. And that's it. Thanks.
Aaron, thanks for joining us today. Mr. Barrett?
Well, I think no one's saying that folks shouldn't go get practically minded degrees. I think the argument here is that it shouldn't be that to the exclusion of the other kinds of things. I mean, I think part of the, back to your last speaker, part of the appeal of a philosophy degree, for example, is that it might help you think about working at a job that that doesn't exist yet. I think that certainly for two-year degrees and for things like agriculture, I think that's what the previous caller talked about. I mean, that's well established through the Moral Land Act as something that is really a critical element of higher education. So, yeah, I don't think I would downplay that. I would just say, you know, these things should be at least on equal footing.
Thanks so much for that call. You mentioned the Moral Land Grant Act, and I was looking at that because it had been a while since my college history courses where I would have run across this. And the original purpose of that was agricultural education.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, I mean, this is it was a great boon to a lot of the states, you know, UW among them, and really I think put things like agriculture on a similar footing, and obviously we've seen how that's paid off in terms of food production in the last 100 or so years.
Yeah, because it wasn't just to teach students about agriculture, it was also to do research into new practices that would produce better crop yields and so forth. Certainly, the dairy industry benefited greatly from research that was done at the University of Wisconsin, for example. And certainly you could point to a lot of other agricultural innovations that came out of university research, which was then transmitted to students.
Sure, and I think that's one of the big arguments right now in the debate going on in your state, that professors' research does inform their teaching and vice versa, that these things can't really be pulled apart so easily.
800-486-8655 is the number to call to join the program. You can participate on Facebook as well. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Pretty lively discussion going on there. You might want to just go and check that out. While listening carefully to the radio. 800-486-8655. We're talking about the purpose of higher education. My guest is Dan Barrett, who is the author of an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education titled "The Day the Purpose of College Changed." You talk a little bit about what happened in Reagan's second term. And, of course, that was the early 1970s. We were at the height of protests over the Vietnam War. It was a very tumultuous period in American history, and a lot of the tumult was happening on college campuses and was being looked at by what I'm going to call the adults in the room with some dismay. This seemed to reinforce some of what Governor Reagan was talking about, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think higher education is not blameless in this whole story. I mean, I think that it certainly, to somebody outside the campus walls, what was going on campus probably must have looked very foreign and discomforting. Not to say it was right or wrong, but to see that kind of tumult was really very, very difficult for them to see. And I think higher education has made choices that have hastened some of where we are now as well. They have pitched themselves, meaning college leaders have pitched themselves and pitched their institutions as great ways to join the middle class. And so it's, of course, that's what students are going to view colleges for, because that's how it's being sold to them by the colleges themselves.
And I think, too, that we need to remember that the economy really shifted in the 70s, and you point this out in your article, that we had the oil embargo of 73. We had had a long, long period of post-war prosperity. And all of a sudden, it was a little bit different. And now we have to start to look a little bit more carefully at where we spend our money. It was a much different situation from the early 70s on than we saw prior to that.
That's absolutely right, yeah. And in terms of who's entering the workforce is starting to change also. We start to see more women, more people of color coming to colleges, more adult students going to college. And for adult students in particular, they quite often have work obligations, family obligations. And so the life of the mind may be all well and good for some people, fitting that description, but they also need to be able to boost their earning power.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Steele in Appleton. Steele, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, in the later 70s, Tucson's University of Arizona had a debate, and they were going to upgrade the library, and then all of a sudden the football stadium needed work. And they chose the football stadium to be upgraded first. And it seems colleges are more known to the public for their football teams than anything else. And the most viewers ever watching TV happened Sunday for the Super Bowl, straight way for a concussion. Thanks.
Steele, thanks for your call. Dan Barrett, certainly the influence of sports, particularly in some of the bigger universities. We talked about this on this very program a week ago, but certainly the influence of sports has to be considered here as well.
Sure, sure. It goes to this idea of universities really, I think, hearing loud and clear over the last 10, 20 years that they need to be run more like businesses. And football teams, particularly the few that are very, very profitable, can be extremely profitable. And in that case, as kind of a straightforward economic decision, you can sort of see the logic as to why they would upgrade the football stadium if it's going to bring in more money. You can certainly fault it on other grounds, but there's kind of a market logic there, I suppose.
Steele, thanks so much for that call. One of the other things that you point out in your article, and I want to address this as well because this is also a discussion that's happening here in Wisconsin, is that as things changed, as the situation evolved in the 70s, one of the things that we started to see was professors had a lot less authority and a lot less power on a lot of campuses, and that's certainly a trend that has continued.
Oh, sure. I talk about a report from the mid-80s that talked about colleges as a kind of a marketplace where professors sort of shop their classes and students are customers. I mean, we start to see around that time a real surge in student satisfaction surveys, almost like customer satisfaction surveys where the students, you know, are grading their professors on how well they feel they were taught. And an important element in all this is that we start to see around this period and after what's called the adjunctification of the faculty, where you have now, according to some estimates, about 3/4 of the faculty are actually off the tenure track and working basically as kind of temporary help in the classroom. And for folks like that, student evaluations can make or break their hiring or ability to come back the next semester. So you start to see more of that market ethos kind of creep in more.
We need to take a break, but I want to read an email from one of our listeners and then have you comment on this after we come back. I'll give you a moment to think about it. Paul's email reads, I associate these changes, the changes we've been talking about today, with a corresponding emphasis on intellectual property over intellectual creativity and corresponding political or practical creativity. One area this may be directly seen is in university research funding, increasingly private and structured to produce private enterprises and profits. The problem being that the resulting intellectual endeavor becomes increasingly balkanized and full of friction. Interesting comments there from Paul. I want to get your reaction, Dan Barrett, when we come back. We're going to take a short break. We still have room for you to join us on the phone at 800-486-8655. Or on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the purpose of higher education and how that has shifted over the last 50 or 60 years. Looking at a speech that Ronald Reagan made in February of 1967 that led to the article by Dan Barrett titled The Day the Purpose of College Changed. That article appears in the January 26th edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Okay, before the break, I read the email from Paul that I want to get your response to. I want to read it again in case anybody just joined us. Paul emails, I associate these changes with a corresponding emphasis on intellectual property over intellectual creativity and a corresponding practical creativity. One area this may be directly seen is in university research funding, increasingly private and structured to produce private enterprise and profit. The problem being that the resulting intellectual endeavor becomes increasingly balkanized and full of friction. Dan Barrett?
I think it's a very astute point that Paul made. It gets into this idea of technology transfer. Universities all over the country, particularly big research institutions, and I think particularly my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin at Madison, regularly touts its ability to spin off private companies, either run by researchers or jumping off of research that has been done in the lab, on campus. And that has certainly led to certain frictions, I think. Again, it gets back to the idea of campuses looking for ways to exist in the marketplace and to view themselves as market actors in ways that then trickles down or proliferates to the student decisions or the decisions that students make in terms of what they want to major in and what sort of programs are being offered. You know, there's a book a couple years ago called Academic Capitalism, which looked at this issue as well, and looking at the pressure on professors to monetize their research.
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, the two buzzwords in education and higher ed these days are innovation and entrepreneurship. We're seeing whole centers of innovation and entrepreneurship, which attract private money and they get buildings and things like that. Meanwhile, education department where teachers get trained, a lot less popular these days.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, again, this gets to the point of colleges becoming kind of the turf on which larger concerns get acted out. Mm-hmm. And right now, there's a sense that I think, I remember reading a statistic that the number of Fortune 50 companies, you know, 10 years ago, you see, you know, if you looked 10 years ago, you would have seen Enron and things like that, and now they're not there anymore. That there's just been this huge churn and change, and so there's this sense that innovation and entrepreneurship are going to be our way out of where we are. And so colleges, I think, are looking to tap into that. Or being asked to, I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Let's go back to the phones. Julius in Augusta, you'll be next. Julius, thanks for being here today.
Yeah. All I got to say is my sister, she went to college and got to be a teacher. This is back in the 60s. We put her through. There was no student loans or nothing. And us boys, there was four of us, stayed on the farm and did the farming. And I worked for a company, Value Implement at Osceola, Wisconsin, and they did farm equipment put into barns and that's the milk. And the price of milk was good in the 80s, but now DFA is paying $11.100 for it. Farmers can't exist on it. So what good would a college education be to us to go to college, get a degree in farming, and lose the farm right away? We sold our farm. We got a real good price from somebody hitting them out cows. I'll guarantee you that. But all these federal programs that are out there, the small farmer, he has no chance of getting any of the money out of them. It's just the big corporate farms, and they're the ones that control everything. So like I told the gal I talked to, it doesn't take a college education to farm. The veterinarian takes care of your cattle, you call him. He goes to college and learns that. We don't. But the pitch manure, like when we started back in the 60s, we didn't need no education. We learned from our dad. We didn't have to go to college. And I can tell you names of people that went to college down there, the university, and we put in big freestyle barns for them, and they lost it. What good did the college education do with them? And he's doing nothing now.
Julius, thanks for giving us that perspective. Certainly, if we go back to the agricultural roots of the land-grant colleges, there was a time when that was really important, maybe not as big an area of emphasis now, but Julius is basically saying, what's the good of this when we just lose the farm anyway?
That's a great point, and I think as he was speaking, it reminded me of some of the arguments I often hear among, you know, from folks who quite often run community college programs and things like, say, welding, where they say, you know, welding as it was in your father's generation was a different job or demanded different sorts of skills, and now because of technology, kind of the curve has gone up or the floor has gone up and people need to be more educated to do jobs that they didn't have to be so educated to do 20, 30, 40 years ago. I think what Julius's point is that certainly education is not going to be a panacea. It's not going to stop someone from losing a farm.
It certainly isn't the answer to all problems.
Sure. Sure, absolutely.
We have a caller who couldn't stay on with us. Tom called and said the liberal education answers the question why. We need more of that.
Hmm.
I think that's certainly a perspective that is threaded throughout your article. Here's a comment from Julie on Facebook who writes, there is such a push for STEM, even on the high school level, that students today don't pursue anything even bordering on creativity or intellectual curiosity. Interestingly enough, though, there is also negative status afforded those who pursue solely a technical degree. It's kind of a two-edged sword. We put down people who pursue technical degrees, and yet our emphasis in the high schools is all toward the STEM fields.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I would point out, too, with STEM, that at least two of those letters, and arguably all four of them, but certainly two are grounded in the liberal arts and liberal education tradition, you know, science and mathematics. Scientists have to be very intellectually curious to ask questions or see connections in data that nobody else is seeing.
I want to go back to your article for a moment because you describe a fascinating history that most of us probably weren't paying any attention to in terms of how higher education developed and how its national associations were trying to face up to some of the issues that they saw and the conflicts within higher education itself about even things like should we be lobbying Congress or not. Talk about some of that a little bit because that dynamic as it played out in the 70s and 80s was pretty interesting.
That was a surprise to me, too. There are, as I think for lots of industries now in Washington, D.C., big clusters of lobbying groups, and I think a lot of journalists and a lot of people who cover higher ed are used to talking with those folks. It was surprising that, especially back in the 60s in particular, the leaders of these associations really saw themselves as representing their campuses or the kind of the interests of some kind of rarefied version of higher education. And so when legislators would ask them questions like, hey, we've got this bill working its way through Congress right now. You know, you could get grants or loans to build facilities. What do you think? You know, do you want it? And the heads of the associations would sort of speak the language of liberal education. You know, they would say, well, on the one hand this, on the one hand that. You know, the larger social import would be this. And they didn't sort of see how to speak kind of the language of politics. And, in fact, they viewed it as vulgar, was what some observers said. It really wasn't until a senator from Pennsylvania in the 60s said, hey, look, get your act together and start talking to us with one voice, that they started to do that. You know, the lone holdout was one association that I talk about quite a bit here, the Association of American Colleges and Universities, that just celebrated its 100th anniversary. They're the ones that have spoken out kind of as advocates for liberal education. They're really the lone higher ed association here based in D.C., you know, the Big Seven that they're often called, that doesn't lobby. You know, they didn't want to kind of get into that game.
Hmm. It's hard to see a way to survive these days without having some sort of relationship with the elected officials, at least so they know who you are, so that they will take your phone calls.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's been at least a tacit, if not even a deliberate recognition of that among some members of that association, the AACNU. They work they're working pretty extensively with state departments of higher ed, where a lot of policy gets made. And they've tiptoed a little bit towards, they say, you know, weighing in on issues of import, you know, things like assessment and academic quality and things like that in the federal level. So even for them, they're kind of creeping in that direction.
Let's go back to the phones, talk to William in Madison next. William, hello.
Hi. Like many, I also am concerned about the condition of higher education in America. In many ways, I'm concerned about two items: lack of courses in history of philosophy, religion, sociology, et cetera, in two-year technical colleges, and two, lack of professors teaching and also having undergraduate students perform actual hands-on research in areas that the professor is an expert. In my case, I went to a four-year liberal arts college, St. Olaf. One of my professors was an organic chemistry professor. He had the patent for Mylar film. and also, and he had me doing organic research as a junior. Then as a senior, I worked with a professor who had the patent for putting hydrogen into the hydrogen bomb. And he had me moving gases through glass tubes, vacuum tubes, and always told me, be very careful. Be very careful. And they never told me what I was doing. He wouldn't dare to tell me. But the point is that in universities, the graduates, undergraduates, don't get hands-on and or learn, get taught by professors. And in the two-year colleges, I feel sad for them. They're not getting a real rounded education. How do you both answer to that, please? Thank you.
William, thanks for your perspective. Don Barrett?
Well, I think a couple things. One, he really put his finger on a real need that I think a lot of people in the higher ed see, which is the need to have students do more what they call undergraduate research, often applied kind of projects that touch the community outside the campus. There's been a really big push to do that. People call them high-impact practices because they know that they have a very high impact on students' learning, on their ability to stick with college and graduate and get something meaningful out of it. So do enough students do it? I think even advocates would say, you know, probably not. But it's certainly something that I think a lot of people are aware of within higher ed. As to his other point, I think a lot of people in community colleges would say, you know, we have liberal arts degrees here and a pretty robust presentation of things like humanities.
Well,
is it enough?
I can say that the technical college system in the state of Wisconsin has a pretty serious liberal arts emphasis, along with a lot of the technical courses, and students take a lot of courses that you would find in the first 2 years of pretty much any undergraduate college program. So that's a change that's happened, say, over the last 50 years or so. You know, Elaine and Colfax had kind of a different perspective than Williams. I want to make sure we get Elaine on here before we run out of time. Elaine, go ahead.
Hi. I have a nephew that went to Harvard Business School, and, you know, that sounds impressive. Wow, Harvard. But he's a really ignorant man, I'm sorry to say. He doesn't know anything about literature, music, art. He doesn't have a historical perspective. He's ignorant about politics, but he knows how to make money, and he knows how to work 60, 70, 80 hours to have a big house at a very young age. But I'm just kind of horrified that he has what I'd say a lack of empathy or even a sense of community in his life from this very narrow, you know, making money at all costs is his whole focus.
All right, Elaine, thanks. We got to let you go because we're almost out of time. Dan Barrett?
Well, I think she's putting her, she's really bringing to light what I think proponents of a liberal education would say that kind of education does. It's something that should broaden you and get you to think about things beyond what you came to college for.
We'll take one more call here very quickly. Leonard, we're almost out of time, so go ahead.
I'll be very quick. Thank you for taking my call. I have two graduate degrees and an undergraduate degree in theoretical physics in a liberal arts. One of the main roles that I've seen for education in our society is creating jobs. It's a very long-term investment, but an educated society will perform economically. Thank you.
Leonard, thanks thanks for that. A nice closing call. Education produces economic activity. That's certainly been the message that the UW has been selling in the state for a long time. And Dan Barrett, comment on that, please.
I think that's one of higher ed's big selling points, and it's true. The question is how deliberately you do that, and how much does it arise as a result of the things that all the different things that colleges do.
I hope that that people will go and read your article because it describes a fascinating history of education, not just from the moment that Ronald Reagan made his speech in 1967, but you take a historical view. Well, you referred to Jefferson earlier, but as we're in the final minute of the program here, this debate is not brand new. This was going on in Jefferson's time as well.
That's right. I mean, Franklin was a little bit skeptical, and then I talk about W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. I mean, this has been an ongoing tension in higher education for centuries and is not likely to be settled anytime soon.
Well, it seems like when we're prosperous, we have a little more time to contemplate. And when we're not, we seem to be in panic mode. That seems to be the pattern here. And you illustrate that pretty well in your article. Thanks for taking the time to come on the air and talk with me today. Obviously, our listeners were more than ready to have this discussion. I really appreciate your article and your being here today.
Well, thank you so much.
Dan Barrett is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He covers teaching, curriculum, and research on higher ed. His article, "The Day the Purpose of College Changed," appears in the January 26, 2015 edition of the Chronicle, and I recommend it to you. It's a very interesting read. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley. We had K.P. and Lisa Nalbandian on air production today. Scott Myers also helped out. Thanks to all of them. We have a link to the article, by the way, on our Facebook page. Look for The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.